Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well. It's been a long time, 2 weeks since I've done one of these live streams. It really feels good to be back. I went on quite a trip around the world. I met with a few billionaires. I'm going to tell you guys about that. Met up with our good friend, Chris McIntosh, and a group of select people. We met in Dubai, some of his friends there. This whole trip was completely kind of on the down low, let's say. What happens in Dubai stays in Dubai. So I can tell you a few of the things that happened, some of the conversations that I had, some of the light bulb moments that I had. We talked a lot about Plan B. We talked about investment strategies. And then on my way back from Dubai, I went to St. Bart's. It was Hugh's birthday on Saturday. So everyone at mentioned Hugh on Twitter and wish him happy birthday. but I also met with the infamous Steve out there, not his real name, but we hung out most of the weekend and most of the day yesterday, Monday, and I actually sat with him when he was putting on some trades. And so I'm going to share that with you guys as well. And let's dive right into it. So let's start with the story. I was going to go to Dubai last week. That had been planned for quite some time. Chris McIntosh, my good friend, and one of my partners in Rebel Capitals Pro, along with our good friend Lynn Alden, called me up a couple months ago and said, "Hey, I really need you in Dubai." And I said, "Okay, that's a 20-hour flight. And it's an 8-hour time difference. Are you sure, Chris?" He's like, "Yeah, I need you there." And I said, "Okay, buddy, if you need me there, you can count on me. I'll be there." So that had been planned. And what Chris wanted to do was really communicate with about 50 or 60 individuals within his network, guys and gals that he knows personally, and bring them all to Dubai to discuss the current problems we have, geopolitical problems, and specifically problems with freedom, liberty, free market capitalism, and discuss solutions so that we could create this community and this network of people that are not only extremely talented, not only have a similar worldview, but also have extensive resources, basically as 50 super, super, super rich people that Chris knows, some in the tech space, some just kind of normal entrepreneurs, and then many fund managers that have made, some of them quite literally billions of dollars, but are all very concerned about the direction that the world is going from a standpoint of freedom and liberty. We talked a lot of Plan B stuff. In fact, I'll share some insights from one billionaire that I spoke with in Dubai about what he is personally doing for his Plan B. He's actually, he was in the UK and they kind of crossed that line in the sand that he had for himself. And so he took action, but the action that he took is going to completely blow you away. Like, you guys aren't going to believe this. And to say that Chris knows some contrarians is a wild, wild understatement. But let's start with going back to Florida, because the week before going to Dubai, I had to fly through Miami to get there. I'm like, "Yeah, I'm just going to take the week off, relax. I don't feel like doing any videos. I'm just kind of burnt out. So let's just go up there and have some fun." I was able to hang out with Breedlove, had a great conversation with him. Breedlove actually moved to Miami. Josh, I don't know if you knew that, but he's got a gorgeous house there, and he set up a home studio. So he and I were able to talk for probably 2 or 3 hours. We had lunch out there. We were talking about not just Bitcoin, but talking about, you know, macro and a lot of what's happening from a geopolitical standpoint and how to increase your personal freedom and liberty. And then we went right over into his studio and talked for another 2 hours. I don't know if that's out yet or not, but we did that last week. And then I went up to West Palm. I had dinner with Snyder, Jeff Snyder. I can share some insights there. We talked for probably 3 hours. We went to Josh, what's the place that you go to, the fancy place? No,
I was talking to Jeff and he said you guys went to Applebee's.
Applebee's, that's it.
And I was laughing. I was like,
I know that's the fanciest place in Lynn, Massachusetts, where you're from, is the local Applebee's. So Jeff and I went to Applebee's and we're there for probably 3 hours talking about the monetary system and banking. We even talked about Bitcoin. We talked about Ethereum. We talked about XRP. We talked a lot about what's happening in that space. And then I went up to Orlando and hung out with our good buddy, Steve Van Meter. And Angelique met me up there. I actually took everyone to pro wrestling on a Friday night. And that was a ton of fun. And then we went to Dubai. So let's go over, first and foremost, Josh, to a map. And I kind of want to go through the trip and just tell the whole story for the Rebel Capitalist community here. So I started off in Medellin. And then went straight up to Miami, zoom in there. And then from Miami, I spent some time there, went up to West Palm, met with Jeff Snyder, then went up to Orlando, hung out with Van Meter. Then I went back down to Miami on Saturday, hung out with Breedlove. And then from Miami, we go all the way over. Actually, fortunately, I was able to get a direct flight. So we go all the way over to Dubai. It's a 14-hour flight. So then I get into Dubai, not last Sunday, but the Sunday prior, and just massively jet-lagged, as you can imagine. And that's where I met up with Chris McIntosh and this group of individuals that are just unbelievably exceptional, to say the least. And just the talent in that room, I can't give anybody's names. In fact, Chris wanted to keep it so much on the down low, and he wanted to really keep it a secret. So he didn't even allow anyone to take in their cell phones. So when we went into the main room to talk and to, we met up in groups, we did presentations, we did all these things. We set up an action plan as to how all of us can communicate moving forward and how we can leverage our individual networks and our resources to push back against not only the politicians, but the World Economic Forum, the UN, the EU, I mean, you name it, basically the Davos types. And you say, oh, George, what can you and Chris do? No. It wasn't just about Chris and I. It was more so about the people that were there were on the same level as the Davos type. So again, I can't give any names, but these are, you know, a few billionaires that they were at that level. So I'm not sitting here saying that I have the resources to fight Klaus or Bill Gates or Larry Fink or anything like that. I can give some guidance. I have a community. I have a platform. I reach quite a few people. So that's kind of what I brought to the table. But a lot of these people there, they are at the same level as Larry Fink, or at a similar level. And they have obviously the complete opposite worldview of Larry and Bill Gates and all the global elite. So again, we tried to get all these people in one room and figure out, okay, what do you bring to the table? And then how can we come together and leverage the individual resources that we have in order to push back and fight against these authoritarians, these central planners, and basically tyranny? You know, how do we get off this road to serfdom here? And so a lot of exciting stuff. But I was in Dubai for the whole week. Now, one of the things, well, let's start with the Plan B stuff. And maybe sometime in the future, I'll have to clear it with Chris. I can give some names, but as of right now, everything has to be anonymous. So this huge fund manager that is based out of the UK, I spoke with him and we actually did a Q&A up on stage in front of the other participants in this group. And we were discussing the fragility of the current banking system. And then we went into, then he and I, at dinner, we sat down and talked, and he was telling me about his plan B that he actually put into effect. And one of the main takeaways from that whole meeting, guys, is that everyone needs to have a line in the sand that is premeditated. So what I mean, and I've talked about that on this channel quite a bit, and especially in Rebel Capitalist Pro, you guys are all familiar with this. But it's the idea that it's not just setting up a plan B. Anyone can do that. It's also, and more importantly, maybe, having a line in the sand that is predetermined. So if the government does this, then I'm gone. Because what I see so often is everyone sets up these plan Bs and then they never pull the trigger. They always make excuses. Well, you know, I'm in Canada and sure, Trudeau seized the accounts of all these truckers that were legally protesting against his insane mandates. But, you know, it's not that bad. They just keep making all these excuses. Where if you have a line in the sand and you commit to it, then if they cross that line, you're gone. You're done. And you guys know that back in 2021, when I started this channel, I was very vocal and explicit about my line in the sand. And those were the mandates. Those were the mandates, and those were the, we'll call them medicine passports. You guys know exactly what I'm talking about. I said, if the United States crosses that line, I'm out. I'm done. They crossed that line. What did I do? I came right back down here. Now, I don't know if this place is any better, but at least they didn't have any of these, the mandates. That's for sure. And when I got back down here, they had some of the things where you had to share, but no one paid any attention to it. That's what's good. And that was another main takeaway from the Dubai trip, is when you're thinking about a plan B, it's actually wise to think about locations where the government is extremely inefficient. And so why? Because even if they do have some stupid rule, which every single government will have, if the government is that inefficient, they just, no one will pay any attention, just like they did here in Medellin for the most part. So, what I want to impress upon you guys is if you haven't, even if you're thinking about a plan B, if you haven't sat back and met with your spouse, your family, and determined what would the government do in the United States or the UK or wherever you are that would prompt me to leave, I need to think about that right now. And then if they do, then boom, you've got your plan. You execute your plan, but you can't do it in real time because then we get too reactionary, we get too emotional, and we don't process thought well when we're in that state. So this fund manager, who billionaire, his plan B, believe it or not, that he actually executed was to, and I know a lot of people are going to get mad at this, but hey, don't shoot the messenger. His plan B was Russia. So maybe 6 months ago, something like that, he literally moved to Russia. Why? Obviously, that was quite contrarian. That's for sure. But he just saw the wokeness that was happening in the West and everything else, and he just wanted nothing to do with it. And he's like, how can I get as far away from that as possible? Well, there you go. So I don't know if he's going to be there long term, but that's his intermediate plan, and that's where he has been. And he actually came down to Dubai from Russia. And believe it or not, there were maybe three or four people in the group that had done the exact same thing. A lot of the people in the group had moved to Turkey, and they didn't move to, I didn't meet anyone that moved to Istanbul. And actually, a couple of people in the group were Americans. A very few people overall in the group were Americans. I'd say maybe 10 out of the 50. But a couple of those Americans had gone to and actually moved to Turkey. But they didn't go to Istanbul. They actually went down to the coast. So let's see if I can find, let me zoom out here and see if I can find some of the locations for you guys. And by the way, every single person that moved to Russia, basically every single person that moved, period, loved it. They said it was the best decision that they had ever made. So, and again, I know there's going to be some people that are not big fans of Russia or Turkey or anything like that, but I'm just telling you, I'm the messenger here. You don't have to like it or dislike it. It's just be cognizant of the fact that there's some very, very powerful, influential people that are thinking this way. Another reason that most of the people went to Russia and or Turkey, resources. They're very, very concerned about energy, commodities, a lot of the things that Chris talks about. and they want to be in an area that is self-sufficient when it comes to energy. I mean, there are a lot of things that went into their decision-making process. Okay, let's shoot over here to Turkey and see if I can find. Most of the people that moved, they moved to the coast. I'm assuming, if my memory serves me right, I think it was this place. They all moved to the coast. And I've never been to the coast of Turkey, but they said it was absolutely fantastic and gorgeous. And the cost of living is low. They said people just completely leave you alone. Believe it or not, even the people that had moved to Russia in the last 6 months said that the Russians were very, very welcoming. And they said they were shocked, quite frankly, that they were so welcoming. But there you go. I'm not saying, you know, look, I dislike all governments equally. And I've been saying this since Russia invaded Ukraine. I hate the Russian government, but I also hate the Ukraine government, just like I dislike the United States government or the Australian government or the Canadian government. But the people, I'm on the side of the people, no matter where they live on the planet Earth, I'm on their side. It's very easy, in my view, to determine who the good guys are and the bad guys. The bad guys are the politicians, the global elites, the central planners, the authoritarians, and they have them in every country. Look, they got them in Colombia, they got them in Russia, they got them in Ukraine, they got them in Canada, obviously in the United States. The good guys are the people at the end of the day. And oddly enough, you know, regardless of what side of the political spectrum you're on, there are some common denominators, I think, that the politicians are there's some common denominators with people, regardless of their political views, that I think bring them together at the end of the day, especially if the politicians, the authoritarians, push them too far. And I think the enforcing the mandates on kids, that was an example, and we'll probably see more examples of that moving forward. So getting back to Dubai, another thing I wanted to share with you was a very interesting conversation I had with another billionaire. I assume he was a billionaire. He was a huge, huge commodity trader, and he had been trading commodities since 1998. And when he started off, I believe he has a PhD in mathematics, and he was working for an oil company. He had no background in trading whatsoever. And the oil company said, hey, we want you to just kind of try to figure out how to hedge out our exposure to the price of oil. And he's like, okay. So his idea was to get a bunch of engineers, scientists, and maybe other mathematicians, I don't know, but not hire traders, and then build algorithms. And what in explaining it to me, we talked for hours one night. And when he was explaining to me, it was actually kind of a precursor to AI, what he built. And because he had all these algorithms that were taking in data, but the algorithms were actually talking to one another, and they were, and each algorithm was using the other algorithms as an input itself to become more efficient and more streamlined. And then at certain points, these, let's just say 10 or 12 algorithms that he have, they acted as variables, and some of the algorithms would override the other algorithms based on the inputs that they were getting from one another. So as an example, let's say you've got 10 algorithms to make it easy, and each algorithm is measured on a scale of 1 to 10 as far as how much impact that is having today on the current price. We talk about this all the time in Rebel Capitalist Pro with the cross currents, right? When you look at the dollar, there's 1,000,000,000 variables that go into that. So what we have to look at are the major cross currents that are at play all the time and determine which cross current is going to overwhelm the others. Inflation, deflation, another great example. We have inflationary and deflationary pressures occurring at all times. At all times. Right now, the United States economy wants to deflate. There's a deflationary backdrop. There's a deflationary pressure with the US economy. No one's going to dispute that. But does that mean that we have consumer price deflation? It depends on what the central planners are doing. If the central planners do what they did in 2020 and 2021, then that inflationary pressure is going to overwhelm the deflationary pressures that are consistent with the underlying economy itself, that the fundamentals of the economy, the structure of the economy is deflationary, not the good deflationary, the bad deflation. So it's the same thing with all of his algorithms in terms of commodity prices. So when we were talking about this, I'm like, I can't mention his name, but I'm like, you know, that was basically artificial intelligence. It's like, yeah, yeah, it's exactly what it was. And this was 1998. So that just gives you an example of kind of how the level of people that are in Chris's network. And the encouraging thing is a lot of times when I'm doing these videos, and I'm sure you guys get this sense in your everyday life too, because a lot of your friends, your family member, Fred, they're all average Joes. And when you talk to them about Klaus or any of these problems with the central planners and the authoritarians, the World Economic Forum, the BIS, the EU, Ursula, whatever, they look at you like you're crazy. And I know even for me, sometimes I've got the rebel capitalist community out there, and I know a lot of people that have a very similar worldview, but sometimes it feels like just the super, super, super rich elite all are Malthusian or are all part of this this cult, quite frankly, that's not only Malthusian, but I would argue has a lean towards eugenics as well. And at the very least are Marxists. And it just seems like every single person that is extremely rich or extremely powerful or extremely famous for being rich and powerful is on the side of the Malthusian cult. And what was fantastic about this event is you see firsthand that that's not true. That's not true. And for me, that was really, really encouraging to know that there's some people that are just as powerful, just as rich, just as influential as the people that you see at Davos that absolutely hate everything they stand for. But getting back to this commodities trader, what we were talking, because we were talking about value investing, and you guys know that I always say you got to buy things when they're cheap and sell them when they're expensive. And I was talking to him about his view on value investing, and he said it's all nonsense, quite frankly, literally. He just looked at me and he said, yeah, that's great. You have that view, but I can tell you I've back tested everything and it doesn't work. I'm like, okay, well, let's think this through here. And so what he was really saying is, value investing without a catalyst doesn't work. And if you think about it, he's right. Because let's look at uranium. One thing that I'm super bullish on, and especially after being in Dubai and talking to these other people, very, very bullish on uranium. But you could have said that uranium was cheap for the last 10 years, and you would have been right, but you wouldn't have made any money. So it's all about going back to Jim Rogers when he says, not just buy cheap and sell expensive, but there has to be a catalyst. And then I said, well, wait, okay. And we were talking about Jim Rogers specifically. And I'm like, okay, but let's think this through, because his big thing was trend following. He's like, you got to follow the trend. You got to follow the trend. And if the trend is up, I don't care what the multiple is. I don't care if it's cheap. I don't care if whatever it is, the trend is up. I said, okay, but let's think about this. I go, if Jim Rogers was going into Germany in the early 1980s, if he was going into Zimbabwe or any of these crazy places where Jim Rogers has gone and made quite a bit of money, I said he bought them because in his mind they were cheap, but he also saw a catalyst. So I asked the commodity guy, I said, is that any different than trend following? And he looked at me and he says, actually, you're right. That's all Jim Rogers is doing, is trend following. It's just that he's really, really good at picking the trend right at the very bottom, but making sure that there's going to be a trend from the standpoint of there being a major catalyst. Where most people, when you think of trend following, you think about kind of picking up the move right in the middle, which is what this guy would do. It's just Jim Rogers took it to a whole new level. But what's funny is if you ask Jim Rogers if he is a trend follower, he'd tell you absolutely not. Absolutely not. And so then we started to think about all these different strategies and approaches of famous people, famous fund managers, who have done well over the years, a lot of the guys in the Market Wizards books. And no matter what they called themselves, and I would even put Chris McIntosh in this category. That's all they're doing is following a trend. You know, we talk about George Gammon. Okay, well, what did I first get into when I retired? I got into real estate. Okay, well, that was effectively trend following because it was super, super cheap. I saw that the catalyst were multiple things. Number one, the price to income ratio. Number two, the rents, how much you were getting as far as an ROI relative to treasuries. And then also with that in particular, now not every asset class is like this and individual stocks aren't like this, but as far as broad asset classes like the S&P 500, housing or commodities, they tend to mean revert. So you've got to compartmentalize there. But that's all I was doing at the end of the day. I was, okay, it's cheap. I'm going to buy it. But there's these catalysts and I'm getting paid to own it. And therefore, likely based on the price to income where they are right now, the trend is going to be up. And what did I do? I start selling in 2018. And as most of you know, I sold my last house in 2022. I thought the trend was up. Why? Because it was expensive. I thought the trend was done. I was wrong, obviously. But I got in so early and I had obviously luck, but I timed it so well that I picked up a good portion of that move. And so, and by the way, if you guys have studied trend following, this gentleman that I was speaking to in Dubai, he knew Richard Dennis. He also knew William Eckert. And if you know trend following, those are like the godfathers. Those are the two guys that set up the Turtle Traders. I'm sure you guys have read stories about the Turtle Traders back in the 1980s. And he actually did some math in. Well, I won't tell that story. That gets a little too personal with William Eckert. But I just wanted to point that out because it's not like he's like Joe Blow trend follower, you know, on YouTube or something like that. That this guy is properly legit. And that was the conclusion that we came to as to why value investors, some succeeded and some didn't. And why XYZ strategy, whatever it is, why some of those guys succeeded and some of them didn't. It all just goes back to the way they structured their trades or structured their investments. They structured them, whether they knew it or not, to take advantage of the benefits that trend following has. So that was a huge, huge, huge light bulb moment for me. And it's something that I'm going to be talking about a lot more on the channel and in Rebel Capital's Pro. So when you're looking at your investments, I'm not saying don't do the buy cheap and sell expensive. We want to do that, but we want to definitely look at that through the lens of trend following. And therefore that catalyst is extremely important. Another thing that we, I'll save this for St. Bart's because I talked to some of the billionaire guys in Dubai about this, but the idea was really crystallized in my mind when I was talking to Steve in St. Bart's. So let me actually write that down so I don't forget to tell you guys. Okay. And by the way, I don't know if I mentioned it. This Friday, I'm going to be doing a webinar in Rebel Capital's Pro. These webinars I'm doing are extremely popular. So if they're popular, I'll keep doing them. And I'm just going to kind of briefly go over my main takeaways from this trip, tell you guys the story, and then I'm going to go into a deep dive on everything that we're talking about here on Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern time in Rebel Capital's Pro. So if you want to do that, you can just do the trial for a buck. You can check it out and you can go to georgegammon.com/pro and you can sign up easy. Do that. And then I'll see you in the live stream webinar within the Rebel Capital's Pro Forum on Friday, where we'll do a deep dive on everything that I'm talking about. Hey guys, I want to invite each and every one of you to join me May 31st through June 2nd in Orlando for Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the annual conference I do. And this year it's going to be absolutely incredible. We're gonna have some of your favorites there as speakers, guys like Jeff Snyder, Mike Green, The Real Estate, Kenny McElroy. We're gonna have Robert Barnes. They're talking about freedom and liberty. Even Rich Cooper is going to be there discussing red pill issues. This event is all about giving you the intel, the insider information you need to not only survive 2024, but thrive. The whole reason I created this event was to give you the tools you need to build the future you deserve for yourself and your family. This is an event you are not going to want to miss. So to get more information, go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. You can see a full list of speakers we've had in the past. You can see clips from past events. And most importantly, you can get your tickets. As we get closer to the event, the tickets go up in price. So you're going to want to get those ASAP at rebelcapitalistlive.com. And we will see you in Orlando, May 31st through June 2nd. Okay, so now let's go ahead and fast forward to the next leg of the journey, which was St. Bart's. So for this leg, I went from Dubai, and this would have been Friday. So last Friday, I went from Dubai straight to Madrid, which is out here. So I go Dubai, Madrid, right around here. And then from Madrid, I had about a two-hour layover, something like that, and then went straight to San Juan, Puerto Rico. And so I stayed the night in San Juan, Puerto Rico, because I got in pretty late and was adjusting to the time, and it was pretty brutal. But the very next morning, I went right over to St. Bart's. Now, for those of you who haven't been to St. Bart's, it has one of the, if not the smallest airport in the world, and you cannot fly a jet in there. In fact, you can't even fly most prop planes. You can only fly one of these little like 8-seater turboprops because the runway is just too small. And the runway, it goes right over a little mountain, and then right out the other side is the ocean. So there are really no direct flights to St. Bart's other than from the islands. So that's why I had to fly into San Juan. Okay, so San Juan, then you get on what they call it, the airline is Tradewinds. It's kind of like a semi-private. It's actually really, really nice. And then that takes you over to right here. Look at how small St. Bart's is. They don't even have it on the map. They just have Gustavia, which is the little teeny town in St. Bart's. But Saturday morning, I go from Puerto Rico to St. Bart's on Tradewinds. And this is where all the action is, right here in St. Bart's. And believe it or not, the island's so small that to drive from right about here, if you guys can see my arrow, to over here, it takes about 15 minutes. So that's, I'm not going to show you exactly where Hugh lives, but I can give you the proximity. So here is Gustavia, and this is the little airport right here. It is a very famous hotel restaurant area. Incredible, just breathtaking views of the bay there. It's called Eden Rock. But anyway, this is Gustavia. And when I was there, they were having a huge like a sailboat competition. I guess they do it once a year. So it was really packed. And the bay was just jammed with these mega yachts and these sailboats and the things that you see in like the, I forgot what that race is called. Oracle always sponsors those boats that go up on one kind of pontoon. Anyway, you guys can remind me in the chat what that's called, but a lot of boats like that. So anyway, so Hugh lives, I'll just tell you, he lives in this area right here. And so what's really amazing about Hugh's place is he's up on this hill to a point where he can see from Hugh's swimming pool or from his house. You can see all these islands. You can see this island, you can see this island, and you can see this island. Oh, then this is St. Kitts and Nevis, by the way. You can see this as clear as day. You don't need binoculars, nothing. It's just like looking out your window. Oh, there's the Caribbean and there's the island. So that's where Hugh is. Anyway, so here I was meeting with you know, we all go out to lunch and then dinner and hang out. Hugh had a big party over at his place for his birthday. DJs, everything you can imagine from the infamous Hugh Hendry himself, the acid capitalist. And so, but then the next few days, Mike and I, well, a bunch of people were sitting down and discussing these different types of strategies for investing. And one of the things that I noticed that came up over and over and over again is something that I heard in Dubai. It's story. What's the story? Tell me the story. So we were talking about NVIDIA as an example, as you can imagine. And we were talking about artificial intelligence. And we were, what's the story right now? Well, you guys know that it's being hyped. It's or another way of looking at this, and the way I kind of articulated this to the individuals I was meeting with, and then to Steve on Monday when I was meeting with him, is it's all about narrative. What's the narrative right now? And one of the things that we discussed on Monday when I was with Steve, and I was actually, he brought me into his, what he calls his office, and he was trading that day because he not only does long-term investments, but he actually day trades as well, still to this day. And so he brought me in. We looked at his computer. We pulled up the charts. He told me what his objectives were for the day. And he was actually day trading NVIDIA. Because if you remember yesterday, the CEO came out and did the whole spiel with the in San Jose, I believe it was, at this conference. And he did this presentation. So Steve thought that you kind of buy the rumor, sell the fact, which is exactly what happened. And so yesterday morning, we were at his office, and he was outlining everything that he was doing. And he was going over the charts, he was going over why he did it, and then he showed me how he was actually putting on the trade just for the day. And it was not going long NVIDIA, I can tell you that. It was using options in some very, very complex ways that we'll get into on Friday during the webinar. That's what we were talking about. That was one of the major themes, is how does narrative impact the price of stuff or assets? How does narrative impact the price of NVIDIA? How does narrative impact the price of uranium? Let's think about the catalyst to uranium. Actually, let me go ahead and pull up a chart. Let's see, Josh, am I boring people yet? Oh no, my goodness, we got a lot of people on here. Okay, cool. So let me go ahead and, if you guys are still interested in this, let me pull up a chart of uranium. We'll go to trading economics. Josh, can you still see this? I want to make sure.
Yep, everything's all good.
Okay, cool. So hopefully I can go back. Yeah, let's go back 25 years. And most of you will be familiar with this chart. So you just had uranium go parabolic just before the GFC in 2007, got up to 140, we'll call it, something like that. I don't think this is adjusted for inflation either, just FYI. But then it just crashed. And we had this bit of a spike, and then it just went lower and lower and lower and lower and lower. And from, let's just call it 2014 to, I mean, even the beginning of 2020, so 5-6 years, it was what you would call dead money. Was it cheap? Absolutely. Was it the future? Sure. In fact, I remember specifically when I first started my channel, talking to Rick Rule about uranium and all of the fundamental analysis that he was going over when I was discussing this with Rick. It all made sense. And it's all the exact same as the talking points that you would use today. It's the exact same argument. But, and I don't know when Rick started making that argument, knowing Rick and his level of sophistication, it was probably in 2019. But you could have made that exact same argument. You could have made that argument in 2014, for heaven's sake. It was the same thing, but you definitely could have made it in 2016. So what was the difference? What was the catalyst? In my opinion, narrative. It was just narrative. Back in 2020, then coming out of the Cerveza sickness, if you guys, and you guys might not know this, or you guys might not be as aware of this as I am. One of the benefits that I have of in doing these videos every single day and doing the whiteboard videos and doing research for those and doing all these interviews, you know, where I'm on other people's shows or I'm having someone on my channel, something like that, is you really have to stay current as to what's happening in the overall macro landscape. You got to be really aware of what's going on in the news with CNBC, with Bloomberg, even if it's in the mainstream news, and what people are talking about. And I remember this like it was yesterday. I'm sure a lot of you guys remember this as well, that in right toward the end of 2020, 2021, people more and more and more started to talk about nuclear energy. And then I think the kicker was when Russia invaded Ukraine. And now all of a sudden, all the Germans, as an example, that were trying to push ESG and the green movement and climate change and all these things, and they wanted to get rid of that dirty, filthy nuclear energy. You know, they had been doing that since right around the late 1990s. In fact, I did several whiteboard videos on that. And now all of a sudden, they're put into this position where not only do they not have nuclear energy, they don't have any energy. Period. Because with the Nat gas, Putin basically gave him the finger, or you guys remember what happened there, to where they couldn't get the natural gas that they needed because that was direct pipeline to Moscow or Lukoil or wherever it was, basically a direct pipeline to Russia. So when Russia becomes persona non grata and all the geopolitical stuff, now all of a sudden, what do they do? And you can't not have energy. So they fired up the coal plants. So it got to a point. I forgot whether this was 2020 or 2023, but Germany was quite literally using the most coal that they ever had used. The coal usage in Germany was at an all-time high. Why? Because the knuckleheads and the insiders and the Malthusian cult that was in charge of Germany since the 1990s really pushed them away from nuclear energy, which when they started pushing them away is a pretty substantial percentage of their overall. If you look at all the electricity sources, the energy sources, is a pretty substantial percentage of that. And like idiots, they just moved it away. And if you guys don't remember my videos on that, I remember it well. The guy who pushed them away, the guy that was in charge, actually, after he's the one that set up the Nord Stream pipeline. And then when, after he got out of office, he actually moved or became like a consultant or on the board of directors for Lukoil and for their natural gas company, and was in the process of building another pipeline. So then you go back and he's supposed to be this greenie. In fact, I think he was part of the Green Party when he was in charge over there in Germany in the late 1990s and early 2000s. I can't recall his name. But you guys look it up, you'll know exactly who I'm talking about. But anyway, so he set Germany up to fail just to pursue his own political interest or just to pursue power, quite frankly. And it put them in a compromising position. Then they use coal. So once they started doing that, I think everyone looks around and even the Greta Thunberg types say, okay, we definitely don't want to use any coal. And so then it opens up the dialogue to just start talking about nuclear, where before you couldn't even talk about it. Like with the Greta types, you couldn't even mention it. But then all of a sudden, because of what Putin was doing, it kind of opens it up to now it's okay to talk about it. Now it's politically correct. You can do this. And even on the left, a lot of the politicians are coming around saying, okay, this is something that we probably have to do. So my point there is the narrative started to shift. The story around nuclear, therefore uranium, started to change. And once the story changed, that was the catalyst that takes us to what we have seen lately. And I know it's come down slightly, but you just had a parabolic move right there. And then I think another catalyst, if you're really paying attention, was the fact that Sprott was basically buying uranium and just putting in a storage unit. So they're taking all this supply off the market. Well, that's probably going to do something to the price as well. So we really dove into how important the story is when you're trying to trade, whether it's on the short side or the long side. Another example that I'll give you, and we're going to get into this more extensively on Friday during that webinar, is Steve's right now, one of the, and I'm not going to say he's putting on this trade because obviously this isn't investment advice. I just have these conversations that are incredible. And I'm very, very fortunate. I'm incredibly blessed to be a part of this network of individuals. And I've made these relationships over the last few years to where I can get this insider information, not illegal insider information, but information that the general public just doesn't have. Like the general public is never going to be able to sit with a billionaire hedge fund manager and quite literally watch him trade NVIDIA for the day, and then sit there and pick his brain over the span of a weekend while we're hanging out with Hugh, but talk about all of these not just strategies but philosophies and all of this experience and wisdom that he has been able to hone since the late 1980s. He's been doing this a long, long time. You cannot put a price tag on that type of wisdom and that type of experience. One of the main things that he's thinking about right now is how the narrative around Tesla has changed and around EVs. And a lot of you would probably look at a chart of Tesla and say, well, George, there's no way that you can short that now. I mean, look, it's really come down. No. He said, and Steve told me this directly. He said he's known some of the best short sellers that have ever lived. And he said that they never, ever try to pick the top of something and they never short something on the way up. So one of the examples that I actually gave as someone who did it incorrectly was Melvin Capital. You guys remember Melvin Capital? Josh, you remember Melvin Capital?
Yeah. Didn't they short GameStop or something like that?
Boom. There you go. And they got completely wiped out. So I was talking to Steve and I'm like, okay, that's an example of what not to do. And he goes, exactly. He goes, they should be out of business. They deserve to, because that was a rookie move. Rookie move. That they had the initial position on, and that was probably smart. But then what they did is when the GameStop crowd just shoots the stock and produces this short squeeze, you know, where it's going from $100 to $200, the Melvin Capital guys took more money and increased the size of their short position. And Steve says, that's the death blow. You never do that. You never, ever, ever do that. Those guys, in his opinion, just let their ego get in the way and they paid the price. Or what they should have done is just when the stock starts going against them to that degree, just get out, get out. Just take your losses, just get out, live to see another day, take a step back, reflect, and determine what you want to do next. And Steve said what he probably would have done is just gone long really quick until he figured it out. But he said that's an example of what not to do. He goes, the best short sellers that he has ever seen don't try to pick the top. And he said they never shorted on valuation. Never, ever, 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 ever. He said that doesn't matter. He goes, you have to wait for a catalyst. He goes, you have to wait for the story to change. And he said, once the story changes, then you can see it in the chart, because the chart will show you lower highs and lower lows. And you're not trying to, if you miss most of the move, he says, you don't even care. In fact, he went over a percentage, and you'll have to forgive me. I'm probably going to need to think this through a little bit more, because this is something we were talking about at Hugh's party at like quite literally 1 a.m. after we had been drinking tequila all night. So, but he said, and I'm going to have to do the math on this, but he was saying something to the effect that when he was in Japan, he had a guy there that was training him or something like that. And he learned, and it dawned on him, that even if you're able to pick the very top of the move, actually, let me pull up a chart of Tesla so you guys can see. So we'll just do like see if we can see it in the 5 year. Okay, there we go. This is really good. So he said, even if you're able to short it right here, let's just say when it was at 350, let's say. He says, you're going to make, let's just say that it goes down to like zero or something like that. You're going to make 100% on your money. Okay, great. But if you short it at like right here and it goes to zero, you're still going to make just as much. You're still going to make, if I'm thinking through this right, and again, this will be more refined because I'll be able to go through the numbers. But basically he says, even if you miss the first part of the move, if you do it right and wait until the narrative has changed substantially, even if you pick it up at 50% down and then write it down another whatever, 50% from where you get in, you're still getting almost as much benefit as trying to time the top, but you have much less risk, was the main takeaway. So what he did actually is then we started to compare the story and the narrative around Tesla when it was just crushing all of these short sellers like Jim Chanos on the way up. You guys remember that, I'm sure. Back in 2020, 2021, 2022, it was just crushing these short sellers, right? And but what changed now? Not much. I mean, the fundamental story is pretty much the same. The only thing that changes is the narrative around the stock. And what's the narrative now? Well, if you guys have been reading the headlines, you see that Ford, all these companies are pretty much went all in with EVs. And now they're like, okay, yeah, that was kind of a bad idea. And then they look at the narrative around BYD in China. Now, if you guys don't know, that's the Tesla, if you will, of China. That's the big electric car company. There's many of them, but that's the main competitor for Tesla. They're being subsidized by the Chinese government. So you know, whether it's right or wrong, Tesla's going to have a hard time competing with that. And by the way, when I go around Medellin, hybrids are much more popular than EVs. But the EVs that I do see, I might see a Tesla once every 6 months. But BYD, I see one every single day. Every single day. So then you look at Hertz. The CEO of Hertz was just fired, or he just quit, something like that. But he was the one that tried to go all in on EVs for the rental car agency. That blew up in his face. Now you have all of these other car companies saying, yeah, we're backing out of the EV. We're going to go more the direction of hybrid, or more the direction of trying to increase the efficiencies of the internal combustion cars that we already have. Because the demand just wasn't there. If the demand was there, for heaven's sakes, they'd fill the demand because they're going to make money. Another thing that I pointed out to Steve, just some anecdotal evidence that was backing up what he was saying about the story changing, is when I went to Miami and to Florida, I actually drove from Miami up to West Palm and then up to Orlando back. So I needed a rental car. So I went to Adriana, my assistant, and I said, hey, let's see. I don't want to deal with any of the little car companies, but let's just see like Hertz or I think it was Enterprise. I'm like, Enterprise, easy. You know, we don't have to worry about it. Let's just go to them. So they brought up a list of their cars, you know, where you type in your dates and everything. And I sorted by price. And the first car that came up was like $20 a day. I'm like, no, that can't be right. They've got to be just on the back end. There's got to be like massive amounts of tax or something like that. And for the entire week or the entire length of time that I wanted it, it was like, let's just say it was unbelievably cheap. It was like $200 or $175. I'm like, this just can't be right. And then I kind of scroll down. And I noticed after the first couple cars, then it went straight up to like $400 for the amount of time. So it went from like $175 straight to $400 for the whole time frame that I wanted to use it. You know, let's say 4 or 5 days. So I'm like, wait a minute here. How can these cars be so cheap? I'm like, they look nice. They're brand new. They're like even bigger than the other cars. You know, like the economy car was like 400. And I'm like, what are they, salvage title? Or are these like smoker cars or something? No, they're EVs. They're EVs. And I'm like, well, that makes sense. Because if you're renting a car and driving from place to place on your vacation, who wants to sit there and stress out over about finding a charging station? Or what are the chances that there's going to be a charging station at the hotel, at the Hilton that you're staying at, or at the Airbnb that you get in Orlando or something like that? Probability is very, very low. No one wants to deal with it. So like, screw it. I'd rather pay an extra $200 and get the gas car. So this is what's happening here. Then you combine that with what Steve was saying, and you see how this story around EVs is changing significantly. And then you look at the chart of Tesla, and you see that it's come down, 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 down. And especially right here since July of 2023, what do you see? Lower highs and lower lows. Lower highs and lower lows. So Steve was considering, didn't take a position yet. Oh, and another thing, by the way, let's look at the PE ratio, 40. And then so yesterday morning when we were in his office, He's like, let me go ahead and pull up the PE ratios on Ford and all these others. And they're like five, like eight or something. And I'm not saying that Tesla shouldn't have a premium for whatever reason, call it self-driving or whatever you want to throw in there. But I mean, come on, right? But again, that was the exact same argument that you could have used back here and you would have been wrong. And what was the difference? Story, narrative changed, and the chart is, you got this classic bearish chart right here. But here's the deal. When he, and I don't know if he's taking on a position, I want to be very, very clear here. But when he was talking about taking a position, he wasn't talking about just shorting Tesla. First of all, he says he's never, ever, ever just go short the stock. He says that's like Jim Rogers. That's like the quick way to the poorhouse in his mind. He said, you only do that with options. I said, okay, how do you usually go long if it's a long-term bet? And he goes, that I'll buy the stock. But on the short side, he goes, I'll only do options. And I'll share a lot of these strategies with you on Friday. But what he did is he said, George, if I do short this, because I love it, I love the idea. He goes, I would only do it if I went long the other car companies. He goes, because I don't want to take any market risk. I said, okay, that's smart. So I said, which car company would you choose? He goes, I'd buy all of them. So he'd go long all the other car companies, the majors. He was talking about Ford, GM, and Toyota, something like that. And then he'd go short Tesla. And the reason is because he didn't want to go long just Toyota, as an example, as a hedge against that Tesla short, because who knows what happens with the management. Who knows what happens if they have some sort of, it comes out that they were trying to get around some regulation. Remember that happened to Volkswagen a few years ago where they had all that PR nightmare because they were getting around that with their diesel engines. I think they're getting around some sort of regulation. And you never know when something like that's going to come out in the press. So he's like, I just want to go long the normal car companies and short Tesla and wipe out any market risk. This is just one of the strategies that we were talking about. Oh, another thing, I was talking to Steve about trend following, and he's like, yeah, that's pretty much exactly what I do. And he says that's pretty much every successful guy that he knows does the exact same thing, even if they're looking at it through the lens of value investing. And but then what he said is, he goes, look, when you're a hedge fund manager, you've got to just, there's a lot of times when nothing is trending. Or there can be many times when the market's just choppy and you can't pick out anything and you still got to do something. You still need alpha. You still got to worry about your monthly P&L. And I go, okay. And he goes, well, let me show you a strategy. If something isn't trending at all, if something is just going sideways. And the example he gave me there was Ford. So let's look at a chart of Ford. And he went back and it literally hasn't done anything in like 15 years. So I think he pulled up a chart going back to something like 2010, right? When it was at, let's say, $13. And he's like, today it's at $13, you know, $12.30, basically $13. And he goes, if it would not have been for the Cerveza sickness on the way down and then the stimmy checks on the way up, you basically could have drawn a flat, literally drawn a flat line from 2014 to today. And Ford would have just, it probably would have been perfectly horizontal. And he goes, but you got to know how to make money in that as well. And I say, well, how do you do it? And he told me a couple of the strategies that he uses to make money on that. And I said, okay, well, the dollar, as an example, has been trending like that for quite some time. He goes, yeah. He goes, I don't really like to play the dollar. But he goes, that's the exact same concept. And another thing that he was looking at to play this way is oil. And he, just as a trading vehicle, he was using options on the USO. Actually, let me write that down, Josh, so I don't forget. So I'm going to say USO trade, I'm going to say no trend. And he went over a couple different ways to play that. And one of the ways really made a lot of sense to me. The only challenge there is hedging any type of tail risk until, you know, just in case you do get one of these big moves up. So there we go. Long video today, guys. We still got a ton of people on. That's really cool. So if you guys are interested in me sharing these experiences with you and these stories, just definitely let me know in the chat. And as a reminder, if you want to take part in that webinar, that deep dive that I'm going to be doing on all of these topics on the whole trip in Florida, what I talked to Snyder about, Van Meter, Dubai, all of the all these influential, kind of the anti-World Economic Forum, if you will. And then what I was talking and getting into the specifics of these strategies that I was talking about with Steve, which if you're new to the channel, not his real name, but he's a very private person. Let's put it that way. He does not like his name out there in the public at all. He's one of those old school hedge fund managers, and he managed billions of dollars, has made billions of dollars, started his career in Japan in the mid 80s or maybe late 80s. He rode that wave up, rode it down. And then in the mid 90s, he went to Silicon Valley, made a killing in the .com boom and bust. And then he made a lot of money in commodities. Then he made a lot of money in the GFC with the crash. And then also he set up a strategic fund to buy real estate. And then he made a ton of money again with Cerveza sickness. And then with the first crypto spike, he made a fortune as well. And he's the gentleman that was very, very bullish on the TLT. We've talked about that in Rebel Capitalist Pro. But what's interesting, he still has the position. He still has the TLT position, but his worldview has changed dramatically, almost 180 degrees since I was there last, which would have been maybe November of 2023. And although he's kept his TLT, he's lost a little bit of money on some of the other positions that he had based on the worldview. But what he's done as far as his P&L is he's made way more than he's lost by, as you can guess, going long NVIDIA. He went long NVIDIA, I think right after maybe December of last year, something like that. So he's been long NVIDIA and really long the TLT, but in much, much different ways. And he's structured in a way as you can imagine, to where he's made a lot of money. So anyway, guys, if you want to be a part of that webinar on Friday, that'll be Eastern time, 2 p.m. Just go to georgegammon.com/pro. You can sign up for $1. We'd love to have you in the community as a member, but you can just that trial period for a week if you just want to take part in that webinar. All right, guys, it's great to be back. We'll see you on the next video.